From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR Sports Show, Only a Game. It's been more than half a century since Clevelanders enjoyed a championship. Will they be ready if the Cavaliers win the NBA title? Ahead on Only a Game, Cleveland hopes for a basketball bonanza. Also, a young jockey tries to buck the odds and make a living wage. A study in contrast between Brazil's greatest male and female soccer stars. And Hammer Time in the Bay Area when MC Hammer was executive vice president of the Oakland A's. Also coming up, remembering the 1981 baseball strike that split the Major League season in two and made a mess of the postseason.
The Reds had the best record in Major League Baseball that year and didn't make the playoffs. So it was kind of a quickly cobbled together solution that was really an artistic failure. And from a ratings and attendance point of view, really didn't help either.
Stay tuned. When the NHL playoffs begin, the players involved grow beards. It's a tradition. Some of the players who aren't involved in the playoffs may also grow beards, but that's up to them and nobody cares. However, NBC Sports Chairman Mark Lazarus does care that the players in the playoffs featured in his broadcasts are bearded. He said so this week. In fact, he said, "Let's get those faces out there," thereby giving me something to bring up in Three Stories You Should Know, our weekly discussion of the sports matters that you might have missed. This week, Only a Game's Karen Given and Patrick Ruby, contributing editor for Vice Sports, join me for that spectacle. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Great to be here.
Okay, so my story is the bearded NHL players. And I think Mark Lazarus, who also said, let's talk about how young and attractive the players are and what model citizens they are, has made a fool of himself. Playoff hockey is often terrific. The Blackhawks and the Lightning have a great final series going right now. And people who don't care about that will not be convinced to care if the players go around appearing more cherubic. If the NHL eliminated fights by suspending the combatants for half a dozen games or so, then the sport might grow. But promoting the players as model citizens who shave regularly is not going to do it. It's just silly. Patrick, what do you think?
I mean, how much of a difference is it going to make if you are not a hockey fan, you're flipping channels, and all of a sudden you see a guy who's in a helmet and in all sorts of hockey body armor and has a visor on, but oh my God, I can see his chin and it's clean shaven. Wow, I'm going to stay here and get into this sport. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Karen?
Well, you know, I don't think anyone is agreeing with Lazarus on this, and certainly not the players. But I actually wonder if it's the quality of beards that's really at issue here, because the beards this time of year in hockey are always so bad.
These
guys are not ready to grow them.
That's true. They're unruly. All right, Patrick, you're next, and I assume that whatever story you bring will be considerably more serious than mine.
It's slightly more serious. It involves some allegations of academic misconduct at the University of Texas with the football and basketball players there. It's a very good story in the Chronicle of Higher Education by a friend of mine, Brad Wolverton. The gist of it is that, as always, players seem to have maybe gotten away with some cheating or being slid through some very easy classes in order to help the school improve its performance of its sports teams in the classroom. We're not talking about lazy or bad students. We're talking about these very elite athletes who often, for various socioeconomic reasons, are not elite students. And the schools bring them in anyway because they want to perform on the field. And now they've created this incentive to cheat. And they pump these kids out on the other side with no real education. And if they get a diploma, it's basically worthless. I think there has to be a better way. And I wonder, and I want to know what you guys think of this. If these schools could stop pretending, if they could say, look, if you come here with NBA-level basketball ability, but a sixth grade reading level, we're going to put you in some remedial classes. We're going to start there. And maybe we won't graduate you in 4 years, but maybe we'll get you on the way and we'll actually educate you. Now, this would require the schools to stop pretending that all these kids just happen to be college kids who are really good at sports. And that sort of is how they defend amateurism. And I think that's why they don't do this. But I think it should change. What do you guys think?
Karen, why don't you take that one?
Well, obviously, I think it's a great idea to actually educate athletes. I also think, and I've been thinking this for a long time, players should be able to come back whenever they want and actually get an education. UNC, Georgia Tech, Syracuse, Michigan, Indiana, they all have programs where players, after they've gone out in the world, can come back and say, hey, you know, I really did want my education. But they have to finish the degree they've they've already started, which half the time has been like the coach has said, hey, kid, why don't you major in communications? Or, hey, kid, why don't you major in physical education? I think they should come back and say, you know, this time I want to be an engineering student.
I think that sounds like a great idea. I worry a little bit about the definition of college-level learning, which is kind of getting lower and lower for students, whether or not they happen to be athletes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the colleges would be a little bit scandalized at first to do this, but if they would just be honest, if they would just admit, look, we're in this big-time sports business now. Everyone seems to like it. It does good things for our schools. The least we can do is actually meet some of these kids where they are and bring them as far along as we can with their education. I think it would be a better deal for everybody.
Karen, it's your turn to come up with a story you think we should all know about.
All right. So my story comes from ESPN's Kate Vague, and I saw this on her Twitter feed this week. It's an academic study by social scientists at Purdue and USC, and it's all about the way that women's sports are covered on TV. And they note that there are some gains in how female athletes are portrayed, less sexualized than they used to be. But they say there's still not enough coverage, and the big statistic that they quote is that only 2% of ESPN's Sports Center involves female athletes. And they make a number of recommendations about how to create more equitable coverage of women's sports on television. But the fact is that television isn't programmed to reflect the way that we want the world to be. It's programmed to reflect the way that the world actually is. And sadly, in America, we use money to show how much we value things. And the money shows that Americans just don't value women's sports as much as they value men's sports. So if you want to change, and I hope you do, I say instead of saying, hey, media, you've got it wrong, let's go out and buy tickets. Let's go to games. Let's buy merchandise. Let's support the sponsors. And then we actually have to tune in and watch SportsCenter, because if we're not part of their audience, they don't need to cater to us.
I mean, I think you're right. At some point, you have to blame the audience. However, there is a bit of a chicken and egg thing, I think, over the long term in terms of building interest in women's sports. But I don't think the answer is just, let's turn over half of SportsCenter to women's sports. In some ways, the audience would feel like you're shoving us down my throat.
I know I disagree with Karen. I think I disagree with Patrick. I don't think television reflects anything. I think television, in partnership with corporations in America, creates interest. They're selling shoes, they're selling drugs, they're selling beer, they're selling cars, and they're selling insurance.
Well, it sounds to me like, Bill, like you're in the Don Draper camp here. Like, we could sell the audience anything if we just put our minds to it. If we could make you drink a Bud Light, Limerita, whatever it is, we could get you to watch the Women's World Cup.
And if the corporations got behind that, they would do it. They would create the interest.
I don't think they're going to create that much of a difference in interest. Look at two of our local sports teams. The New England Patriots have an average attendance of more than 68,000 a game, and you practically have to rent out your spare room to afford a ticket. The Boston Breakers only get 2,500 people a game, and tickets are as low as a dollar. That is not the influence of media. That is us choosing where we want to spend our dollars.
My guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been Only Games Karen Given and Patrick Ruby, contributing editor for Vice Sports. Patrick, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Karen will wrestle with this when we get back in the office.
This fight.
Marta has 15 World Cup goals, more than anyone else in history, and Brazil leads 2-0.
Marta, five times designated by FIFA the world's best female soccer player, is leading Brazil's effort to win that country's first Women's World Cup. The Brazilian men's team has 5 World Cups to their credit, though things didn't work out for them last year. One of the most celebrated players on that Brazilian men's team is Neymar Jr. Gwen Oxenham played briefly for a Brazilian professional team called Santos, and she has recently written about the two Brazilian stars, both known as magicians, for their play on the pitch for The Atlantic, and she joins me now. Gwen, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Neymar Jr. plays his club soccer for Barcelona. He is one of their most splendidly compensated players. He's paid somewhere over $10 million a year. And Marta?
Well, Marta is struggling to find a team to play on. Since she started her career, 7 of the 8 teams that she has played on have folded for financial reasons. The fates of Brazil's two magicians have definitely been very different.
Back in 2011, when Neymar and Marta were both playing for Santos FC, Neymar may have cost Marta a job. I'm sure he didn't do it on purpose, but explain, please.
Neymar was just the god of his country, and Santos did not want to lose him. But the European teams have a much larger financial budget. So Santos, in an effort to keep up with them, to keep their star, tried to find the funds to keep Neymar. And part of the way they did that was by cutting the women's side. So it was a depressing thing to be a Santos women's player. Erica, one of their stars, you know, you can see her interviewed and she's just near tears, trying not to cry, just saying, you know, we love to play. We just want to play.
Still, there has been a kind of progress, certainly, in Brazil. From 1941 until 1979, it was actually against the law for women to play soccer there. How did that restriction come into being?
Actually, it was really interesting. In the early 1900s, women's soccer was spreading like wildfire. Women loved it, and there were teams cropping up everywhere. And so a concerned citizen wrote a letter to the government saying, you know, this is very alarming, and this is dangerous for women's nature. And that letter helped prompt a law that forbade women from playing any sports that run contrary to their feminine nature. Mm. The women that I played with in Santos all grew up playing with guys on the streets. They'd never played organized soccer until very late in their career. So the women's game basically grew out of nothing.
Tell me more about your own experience playing in Brazil.
When I played, we lived 4 or 5 girls to a room. We hitchhiked to practice. We played on fields that we shared with the horse, and we were never allowed to play on the men's field. Our star player had given up soccer twice before because she could make more painting toys at a toy factory in Sao Paulo. But they love to play. It's their country's passion, and they want to be a part of it.
Female players in Brazil have certainly been inspired by Marta's success, but what about the population of the country in general?
Brazilians are iffy about it. You know, there is very much a machismo culture, and when I played in Brazil, our stands were usually empty. However, Brazilians also love magicians, and Marta is definitely that. So what Canada offers is a chance to really hopefully get their country on board this World Cup. Brazilians want World Cup titles, and if the women manage to finally land that title, it could do huge things. And to make it more like it is in the United States, where it's encouraged for girls to play soccer, and the Brazilian players are all very aware of that when they step on the field.
Gwen Oxenham wrote about Neymar and Marta for The Atlantic. She's also the author of Finding the Game. Gwen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The Cleveland Cavaliers are 2 wins away from claiming the NBA title. To be fair, so are the Golden State Warriors, but it's been more than 50 years since Cleveland won a title in any pro sport. So, in Ohio, an NBA championship would not be taken cavalierly. Nobody perhaps knows that better than Cleveland Plain Dealer columnist Terry Pluto. Terry, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill.
Cleveland last celebrated a pro championship when the Browns were the best team in the NFL, and if you were 20 years old when that happened, you'd be somewhere around 71 today. Walk us through a couple of the closest calls that you remember, times when the city thought one of its teams might hoist a trophy again.
Bill, the interesting part of how they do Cleveland Misery on national TV is they show, for example, Michael Jordan hitting a shot against the Cavaliers.
Mm-hmm.
They neglect to mention that that was a first-round playoff game. All right? They show something called Red Right 88, where Brian Sipe throws an interception in the end zone against Oakland. That was a first-round playoff game.
Oops.
The drive and the fumble to Denver, they make it feel like it was a Super Bowl. It was not. It was a game away from the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So the only real, they were so close but didn't get the title, was the 1997 Indians, where they had a 1-run lead in the 9th inning in the 7th game in Florida, and the Marlins came back to tie it and then win it in extra innings. That's one of the things about our misery here in Cleveland. It isn't misery in the finals. It's misery that we almost got to the finals.
So what does that sort of drought do to the collective mindset of Cleveland sports fans?
Actually, I'll be fascinated to see what people will do here if they actually won one, because it's become so part of the identity of the Cleveland sports fans. I remember a few years ago, ESPN had a thing where they said, well, Cleveland is the most miserable, pain, tortured city in sports, barely edging out Philadelphia. And I wrote this whole column incredulously, barely edging out Philadelphia. We're a lot more miserable and we're a lot worse off than they are. And I listed, you know, the different things they had. But other than the close call in 97, our close calls, frankly, aren't all that close.
After returning to Ohio, LeBron James teamed up with Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving. Love injured early in the playoffs. He won't be back. Irving hurt in game one of the finals. He won't be back. LeBron really is trying to do an awful lot of this by himself. Does that create a sense of doom in Cleveland, especially after Golden State won game four with, I would have to say, relative ease?
For the most part, the fans have been terrified ever since the finals began that they would get this close and not win. And then to see Irving be hurt, he fractured a kneecap. And by the way, I'm fearful that if the Cavaliers do not win, this will now become the kneecap.
That's how it'll go down in history.
The drive, the shot, the fumble, the kneecap. They got kneecapped.
Is there any sympathy in Cleveland at all for Golden State? I mean, the Cavs have never won an NBA title. Short answer.
No, don't even go there.
40 years since the Warriors have...
Oh, they got the Giants. They got the 49ers. Go away.
Oh, that's
that
I forgot.
No, we're miserable. We're proud of it. I mean, we've earned our misery. The 4 years that LeBron was gone, the Cavaliers combined had the worst record in the NBA.
Misery. Thy name is the Cavaliers without LeBron.
Right. I mean, the remarkable thing now on the good side is what LeBron James has done, taking his battered crew through the playoffs. If 6 months ago somebody said to you, it's now a three-game playoff for the NBA title, would you sign up for it? You certainly would, and so would every fan here. And LeBron James, if he doesn't win the title, he'll be viewed, you know, heroically in terms of sports. And if he does, forget being on Cleveland Sports Mount Rushmore. He's now on Mount Everest.
Terry Pluto is a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and he's the author of lots of books, the most recent of which is Glory Days in Tribe Town. Terry, thank you very much for speaking with me. A pleasure as always.
Glad to do it, Bill.
Last weekend, 43-year-old Victor Espinosa became just the 12th jockey to ever win the Triple Crown. There are an estimated 2,000 jockeys racing in the U.S. at a time when the industry is shrinking, so Espinosa and other high-profile jockeys are part of an elite few. Only a Games Ann Marshall spent time with a young jockey just starting out, and what she found was a difficult world offering prohibitive odds for success.
It's Kentucky Derby Day at Churchill Downs, and I'm 100 miles north of the spotlight to meet 23-year-old Richard Oliver. He's on the backside of Belterra Park Racetrack in Cincinnati.
It could be a very busy morning or it could be a very quiet morning. It depends who's got what going on.
Richard's looking for a trainer who may need him to work out a horse. His dark red cowboy boots hustle quickly through a maze of 33 barns.
Hey, is Joe needing a hand this morning at all with anything?
No, we're all good. Yeah, I have two guys on staff, so we're pretty covered with riders.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Right?
I just checked by.
Hey, good to see you. Take care.
Richard moved to the U.S. in January. The native of England wants to be a great American jockey. How do you do that? Ride the best horses and win. So every day he arrives at area tracks around 6 in the morning to work out horses. Richard hopes the horse trainers will decide he's a good fit and mount him in afternoon and evening races.
It's networking, it's speaking to people and showing your face that you're here to work. And unfortunately, to kind of reap the rewards, you have to work for free a lot.
Richard says he grew up a chubby farm kid. He always loved horses, but at 15 years old, the jockey dream hit him. He lost 60 pounds in 3 months. His parents feared he had an eating disorder. At 16, Richard left home to pursue jockey school and work as a stable boy. Like most jockeys, he now appears delicate, 5'6", about 110 pounds, 2% body fat. With his boyish face and big blue eyes, he could pass for a teenager. But he carries himself like a professional. He clutches a whip and wears a black riding helmet. Richard spots a slightly hunched trainer with gray stubble.
You wanted to get those two fillies out this morning?
Yeah.
Richard's new to the game, so he can't be too choosy about which horses he mounts. He and the veteran trainer talk about the races the day before.
I ran third and fourth yesterday.
Well, you got to remember, this is cheap track, and it's got cheap horses.
Mm, yeah.
And this is what you run. The horse I run, he's kind of a cripple, but he runs sound, he trains sound. Yeah. I keep the soreness out of him, and he runs.
It's harsh to call the newly renovated Belterra Park cheap, but well-known trainers with top horses don't come here. Purses are small. Richard's third and fourth place finishes the day before earned him about $250 total. After paying his agent, the person who helps him with his race equipment and other costs, he pocketed about $185. The days he doesn't place in the top four, he earns only a mount fee, $55 to $100 depending on the track. Sometimes he goes home with $0.
Some days I get mad because I'd be riding nothing. It's not through my fault I'm not working. Maybe isn't the horses running that I usually ride or whatever. Like, it's a pain.
Still, Richard moved to America because there's more opportunity here. It's not uncommon to hear of famous Latin American riders who came from nothing. Take Victor Espinoza, the jockey who rode American Pharaoh to Triple Crown victory. He's one of 12 children who long ago worked as a bus driver in his native Mexico. Richard now needs to rack up wins. Today, he'll mount a 10-year-old thoroughbred named Borden Brave, a horse going off at 8-1 odds. The race is 6 furlongs, or 3/4 of a mile. Borden Brave struggles at the back of the pack and stays there. Richard crosses the finish dead last. Dirt cakes his face, white nylon pants, and lime green silks. He walks past me without saying a word and disappears into the jockey's locker room. I meet Richard and his wife, Clementine, in their small basement apartment not far from Belterra Park. 32-year-old Clementine is making her husband some black tea. The couple lives with their dog and 2 fish. Kids, maybe someday. Right now, finances are too unstable. Clementine works part-time as a track photographer, so she often watches Richard race. That's good and bad. She was there when he fell off a horse. Richard's nose broke, curving left like the letter J.
He doesn't realize how much I worry about him, but but it's hard. I worry a lot. I have to kind of just let it just go over me, or else I'd just be a nervous wreck.
Richard's lost a patch of hair the size of a tennis ball on the back of his head due to poor diet and stress. He smokes to help curb hunger. Clementine listens as Richard recites his weight loss routine in the days before races.
Tomorrow's the day before racing, so I'll be losing weight all tomorrow and all Friday morning, possibly tonight, through sweating and taking laxatives and exercise and various other things. You know, there's a combination of stuff that I've found works for me. Some people don't eat, some people starve, some people sweat, some people there's something called flipping, which is essentially bulimia.
Some riders crumble under the pressure to stay light. The most severe mental stress often comes after a fall that leads to serious injury. But none of this will deter Richard. His wife and fellow jockeys tell me he's too stubborn and absolutely loves the rush. Back at Belterra Park, Richard smokes as he waits to race. It's a sunny May afternoon, blue skies and a big crowd.
It's horrible in the winter when you're riding and there's like 5 people stood in the grandstand. Like, one of them's like some old guy who stands there and abuses you all the time.
In the weeks since Richard's last place finish, things have improved. He's won 7 races and placed top 4 dozens of times. Trainers are taking notice. He's a good finisher, one trainer tells me. I see that when he mounts a filly named Cassie. I stand near Cassie's assistant trainer, who's pressed against the rail watching the 3/4 mile race. In the 9-horse field, Cassie's got 12-1 odds.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, Cassie. She's getting tired. Come on, come on, come on, Richard. Fire, Richard. Come on, come on, come on.
The pack charges past the turn at 35 to 40 miles per hour. Cassie starts to fade, but Richard pushes her to surge on the outside. He finishes third and hops off the horse, smiling.
She ran a lot better, that filly.
Richard doesn't mind the third place finish or all the hard work. He will do what it takes to become a great American jockey.
It's one of them things, it's like, well, why do you do that? And it's because, like, I don't know, but I couldn't not do it. I have no idea what I'd do if I could ride horses.
For Only a Game, I'm Ann Marshall.
It was not the worst of times for baseball fans. That would come in 1994, when there was a work stoppage and no World Series. But the 1981 baseball season was the first season to be interrupted by a strike. It also featured the phenomenon of Fernando Valenzuela, among other attractions, which is perhaps why Jeff Katz decided to write Split Season 1981. Jeff Katz, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
Describe briefly the series of events that led to the work stoppage back in 1981.
What led directly to it actually culminated in 1980, when a strike was narrowly averted. The owners had been trying to kill free agency, which the players had been granted at the end of 1975. But the owners started throwing money around in ways that was quite shocking to themselves as well as the players. And realizing they couldn't control themselves, tried to collectively bargain a way into controlling themselves, which was in effect to make free agency into a trade. The players balked, with free agency compensation left on the table. It was head on into a strike of 1981.
The 1981 season before it was interrupted was terrific, featuring the dominance of Dodgers ace Fernando Valenzuela, Pete Rose chasing Stan Musial's National League hits record. What did MLB lose from a purely baseball standpoint at the strike?
Well, as you say, Fernando Valenzuela was slated to be a starting pitcher for them in 81 through a series of injuries to some of the veteran starters. He pitched opening day at Dodger Stadium, shut out the Astros, and went into a remarkable string of shutouts, five in his first seven games. Missing a solid block of the middle of the season deprived all of us of seeing how a full year of Fernando would have worked out. Pete Rose was on a quest to tie and then break Stan Musial's all-time National League hit record. He tied it on the eve of the strike, which led to this sad scene of 3,631 balloons let loose over Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia, the record just within reach. The strike hits 2 days later, but when the season resumes on the first full day of play, August 10th, Rose breaks the record. So we missed kind of an immediate breaking of the record.
Unless I'm misreading it, your book has a hero, and that hero is Marvin Miller. Tell us a little bit about how he helped Major League Baseball become the success that it is today, despite the efforts of the men who owned the ball clubs when he was opposing them.
Miller came from U.S. Steel and really explained to the players, here was labor law, here was what was possible. He was really an educator, and the game today is really a creation of Marvin Miller. There are some who would say that's a terrible thing, but the fact that every team has a chance at getting great players was really a remarkable change from the past in baseball. So I do see Miller as a big hero in the game's history.
You are not kind to former MLB Commissioner Bowie Kuhn in your book. You point out that baseball's growth came despite his efforts. One might almost conclude from Split Season 1981 that Mr. Kuhn doesn't really deserve a place in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I always have to put a disclaimer on that. Even though I'm mayor of Cooperstown, I'm separate from the Baseball Hall of Fame. I love the place, and I love the people who work there. Given my druthers, I'd rather see Marvin Miller as a Hall of Famer than Bowie Kuhn. But baseball, you know, has its orthodoxy, and commissioners tend to get in.
The first half of the 1981 season ended on June 12th. The second half began in August. What changes were made as a result of the season being split in half, and who made the decisions about how to do it?
Bowie Kuhn really liked the idea of having a fresh start. He felt that teams that were in last place or performed terribly in the first half, teams like the Mets, the Toronto Blue Jays, Seattle Mariners, that they might get an attendance bump if they could start from scratch. There was also a clause in the national TV contract that gave the owners permission to add an extra level of playoffs, which we're used to today, but then was quite different. So the owners and the commissioner thought there was a potential for some big revenue by adding a level of playoffs. What really was a problem, and the Cincinnati Reds president, Dick Wagner, said this in one of the meetings. He said, look, if you're going to crown two separate half winners, What about us? We finished a half game behind the Dodgers in the first half. What if we finished close behind the Astros in the second half? By these rules, we wouldn't make the playoffs. And that's exactly what happened. The Reds had the best record in Major League Baseball that year and didn't make the playoffs. The Cardinals had the best record in the National League East and didn't make the playoffs. So it was kind of a quickly cobbled together solution that was really an artistic failure. And from a ratings and attendance point of view, really didn't help either.
The Dodgers and Yankees made it to the 1981 World Series, which the Dodgers won. But should there be asterisks affixed to the finalists?
If you're a Yankee hater and a Dodger hater, I'm sure you're pro-asterisk.
Jeff Katz is the author of Split Season 1981. He's also the mayor of Cooperstown, New York, home of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll hammer out what the Oakland A's have to do with this.
You can't touch this.
But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Grandmaster.
You were in attendance at Belmont Park last weekend when American Pharoah became the first Triple Crown winner since affirmed back in 1978. I assume a good time was had by all, especially winning trainer Bob Baffert and winning jockey Victor Espinosa.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great scene. It was one of the best things I've ever been to in my sports writing career. But the interesting thing was, had they not won, Victor Espinosa would have competed for the Triple Crown three times and been denied.
Right.
Baffert would have trained horses four times and been denied in the last race. They would have been the Minnesota Vikings and Buffalo Bills of Triple Crown racing.
Horse racing, as we have all been told over and over again, is a sport in decline. Why do you think we've all been so caught up in American Pharoah's Triple Crown success?
Because it's a thing. It's the Triple Crown. Why are we caught up in, you know, figure skating and gymnastics every 4 years? Not because it's figure skating and gymnastics, but
it's
because it's the Olympics. And this is a thing that hadn't happened in 37 years.
Charlie, I know
which,
that,
by the way, might as well be 300 years in our current accelerated society.
I know that there's no crying in baseball, but is lying okay when you're coaching a team in the NBA Finals?
I don't know, but lying about Andrew Bogut seems to be a waste of time. Yeah, Steve Kerr lied about whether or not he was going to start Andrew Bogut before the fourth game of the NBA Finals. It just, you know, play him, don't play him. It's not central to the series.
It only would have been a great story, as far as I'm concerned, if after the game had started, the camera had gone to the coach and he'd say, "Hey, see what I did there? This is pretty good, huh?"
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Psych.
This series between the Golden State Warriors and the Cleveland Cavaliers is now tied at two games apiece. I assume these finals are living up to the very high expectations you expressed some time ago.
Yeah, it's a terrific series. I wish Cleveland were healthier.
Oh, yeah.
I wish Kyrie Irving were playing. I wish Kevin Love had stayed healthy. But you're seeing, at least on that side of the ball, how great LeBron James really is, because physically, he's not what he was either. And he's keeping this team of I don't want to say cast-offs, but certainly second-line players afloat.
LeBron James's encounter with a courtside camera in Game 4 has inspired a chorus of I-told-you-sos from players and former players. It's a shame that nobody's invented a lens for a camera that would allow you to get close-ups even though you were far away.
Yeah, it's amazing. I just was watching the news the other night, and I saw pictures of the surface of Pluto. And I guarantee you, there was nobody sitting on the surface of Pluto taking those pictures.
Kneeling Pluto side?
Kneeling on one of the moons and focusing in. If only someone would invent a telescopic camera lens.
It'd be great. Barack Obama is said to be neutral as far as the NBA Finals are concerned, but he is rooting for the Chicago Blackhawks in the National Hockey League Finals. Would it be impolite to call the President of the United States a homer?
Cheap. Cheap. So cheap. Hiding from the NBA question by diving into the NHL. Very cheap, big guy.
The Tampa Bay Lightning boast a more biblical following. Do you have a favorite among the messages our Savior Lutheran Church is sending out to their home team?
This is great. We have a pile of them, actually, because they're apparently putting a new one up every day. But I think my favorite one says, "Solomon was wise, but Killorn went to Harvard."
So who wins, God or the president?
I think there's no question that Tampa wins now, because God does have a sense of humor. And I think he's smiling on the Our Savior Lutheran Church and school.
Walter DiGregorio, late FIFA's director of communications, made a funny this week, Charlie. Here it is. If FIFA's president, its secretary general, and its director of communications are in a car together, who's driving? And the answer is the police.
That's a great joke.
It is. Unfortunately, I guess we can't say of Mr. DiGregorio, he'll be here all week.
No, he won't. Well, he'll be somewhere all week.
He's lost his job.
It won't be in FIFA headquarters because he got fired for telling the truth.
Meanwhile, FIFA has postponed the bidding process for the 2026 World Cup. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps it takes them that long to sort through the envelopes. I have, you know, the plain brown ones
that bulge
suspiciously. Either that, or they've decided that they're going to do this one honestly, and they just don't know
how. They don't know how to do it.
And they need more time.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. They're all looking at each other saying, you know what? We can't do this.
Has anybody in our room ever done anything on the merits?
Right.
Anybody? You there, sweeping up in the back. Have you been an honest janitor? You decide where the World Cup is going.
Pia Sundhage, who now
Say that again, because that's a great name.
Pia Sundhage, who now coaches Sweden, used to coach the U.S. women's soccer team. And this week she announced that a couple of those U.S. players, whom her team would soon face, were difficult to coach and prone to trouble. Is this a calculated move?
I think it probably is, but I think it would be very hard to argue at this point that Hope Solo, for example, isn't a little bit of hard to handle.
Prone to trouble.
Not just if you're Pia Sundhage, but if you're local law enforcement.
And finally, Charlie,
when
athletes fail tests for performance-enhancing drugs, it often enhances their ability to come up with creative excuses for the test results. Kang Soo-il is a striker for the South Korean men's soccer team, and he may have taken the lead for best explanation ever for a failed test. What do you think?
Yeah, he failed a PED test, and he blamed what he called mustache-growing cream.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually is such a thing as mustache-growing cream. And I think suckers are being born at a far bigger rate than one every minute these days.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce and his mustache at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Stop. Hammer
time. Oh, wait a minute. What's it? Oh, MC Hammer, the Oakland-born rapper, famous for his 1990 hit You Can't Touch This. He's now known for being a Warrior superfan. He's a regular fixture at Golden State's Oracle Arena. But long before he was cheering Golden State on its run to the 2015 NBA Finals, Hammer was working for another Oakland team, the Athletics. Claire McNear of Vice Sports has written about MC Hammer's time as A's executive vice president, and she joins me now. Claire, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
How did MC Hammer, who used to be known as Stanley Burrell, begin working for the Oakland A's back in the early 70s?
So there are a lot of stories about what it is he did to get the job with the A's. You know, he grew up in Oakland, and he used to go to a lot of A's games. And the stories are that, you know, maybe he was selling baseballs outside the Coliseum, or he was scalping tickets, or he was doing a dance routine to James Brown, or he was beatboxing. But whatever he did, he managed to catch the attention of the A's owner, this guy named Charlie Finley, who had kind of made a name for himself with, let's say, less than orthodox ideas. And he caught his eye. And Finley hired Hammer to come in and work as a bat boy.
What exactly was MC Hammer's, or Stanley Burrell's, role with the Oakland franchise?
So he did a lot of different things. He started working for the team when he was just 9 years old. This was 1971, really early in the Oakland A's history. They had only come to the town in 68. And so he started as a bat boy, but I guess Charlie Finley took a liking to him, and he started doing odds and ends. He was sort of an all-purpose gopher. Mm. As the years went on, Charlie Finley started spending more time in Chicago, where his insurance business was based. And so Hammer would go up to the owner's box at the Coliseum, and during games, he would call up Charlie Finley long distance and give him the play-by-play.
Somebody had to do it.
That's right. And actually, Charlie Finley liked it so much that one game, he informed the A's longtime announcer, Monty Moore, that he wanted Hammer to go on air on the actual A's radio station and do the play-by-play. You know, Hammer went on air and he was doing the play-by-play, and radio executives forced him off air after half an inning.
We have spoken before about Charlie Finley's mismanagement. He eventually fired most of the team's front office. How did Hammer manage to stick around, and not only stick around, but climb all the way up to the position of executive vice president, whatever that might have meant with the A's at that time?
You know, he was pretty cheap. He was paid $7.50 a game, which was a pretty good haul for a kid. And, you know, he'd do whatever needed doing. And Charlie Finley fired just about everybody else. They had just half a dozen people working in the front office, including his cousin at one point.
How did the A's players feel about a teenager parading around the Coliseum wearing a hat with the letters VP on it?
Well, I think most of them were pretty amused by him, but it got to be that as Charlie Finley spent more time away from the team, Hammer developed a reputation for passing on gossip that he picked up in the clubhouse. So they called him Pipeline. So he'd walk into the clubhouse and they'd say, "Oh, here comes Pipeline," and hush up whatever they were saying.
However, baseball and his connection to baseball did eventually help him launch a music career, right?
That's right. Yeah, he stayed in touch with a couple A's outfielders, and he was in the Navy for a few years, and he got back, and he decided he wanted to get a music career going. And so he got in touch with these outfielders, who were named Dwayne Murphy and Mike Davis, and convinced them to give him a loan to start his first label and put out his first album. He actually followed Mike Davis to spring training and has this story about pushing back a table and launching into a dance routine for Davis and his wife, and Davis wrote him a check right then and there.
Music career may not be quite the appropriate term, as I understand it. The mansion went, bankruptcy followed. The career was not exactly a long-standing one.
You know, actually, he had the mega hit that he's known for, which is You Can't Touch This.
Mm-hmm.
And he followed up with another hit, Too Legit to Quit. But, you know, it bankruptcy happened and all that. But he's actually still making music.
I didn't realize that. You can still hear him.
He
it's still Hammer Time.
That's right. It is still Hammer Time.
You can link to Claire McNair's Vice Sports piece, Golden State Warriors Games Have Become Hammer Time, at our website, onlyagame.org. Claire, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Absolutely.
The College World Series is underway this weekend in Omaha, Nebraska. For many, this will be the last stop in a long and successful baseball career. Some will go on to the major leagues, but fewer still will go on to accomplish the unprecedented, which is what former Texas Christian University pitcher Brandon Finnegan did last year. Greg Eklund reports.
My name is Brandon Finnegan. I am a professional baseball pitcher. Before TCU, I was just a Fort Worth kid. My dad taught me and my brother how to play baseball growing up. Started playing when I was four. Started pitching when I was, I think, 10.
When he was 17, Finnegan attended TCU's baseball camp. After seeing him deliver just one pitch, TCU head baseball coach Jim Schlossnagel offered Finnegan a scholarship on the spot.
You know, he was a kind of a squatty body guy, not very tall, but he had a really quick and live arm. He didn't have a whole lot of idea where the ball was going, but he was also a really good athlete, wasn't a bad hitter, and was a pretty good outfielder.
And now, here's the starting lineup for your home team, your TCU Windfrogs.
But TCU's 2013 season was a big disappointment, after which Finnegan and his teammates weren't thinking about making history. They were only thinking about how to improve the next season.
We had expectations. We had a really bad season as a team. We went 29-28. It was horrible.
Kirk Sarlos, pitching coach and recruiting coordinator at TCU, in that first year, he pitched good, but just didn't get any run support, didn't win a game. Going 0-8, we had a terrible year. But it all came full circle in his junior year. He put it all together and led the best pitching staff in the country.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the College World Series.
We made it to all the way to the World Series, and that was a dream.
And on the hill, electric first-round draft pick by the Kansas City Royals, 17th overall, the left-hander Brandon Finnegan.
We just went on a big roll. I think we went on like a 9-game win streak, lost one game, went on another 8-game win streak. And we were just rolling.
The pitch. Hold, strike three over the outside corner. Laprise was frozen. Finnegan went right after him.
Despite Finnegan's strong performance on the mound, the Horned Frogs were eliminated 2 days later against Ole Miss.
We ended up losing and getting put out, and I thought, that was the worst thing that had happened to me in baseball. I mean, it was sad because I knew my career at TCU was over.
But in one sense, Finnegan's real accomplishment was still ahead of him. 10 days after TCU's season ended, Finnegan joined the Kansas City Royals Class A affiliate in Wilmington, Delaware. A month after that, he moved to Northwest Arkansas, where the Royals have a Double-A team. And a month after that, as the Double-A season was coming to an end, Finnegan got called into his manager's office again.
He said, "Heard you got a new car." I was like, "Yeah, I'm driving it home tomorrow." He started laughing. He goes, "You're not going home." He goes, "You're one of the big leagues, kid. You just got called up." And I was just like, wow.
Kansas City was in the middle of a pennant race and needed some pitching help. Finnegan went from starter to reliever and became a key contributor to the Royals' 2014 playoff run.
We just went on a roll. We won 8 games straight in the postseason, and it was just crazy. The fans were awesome, you know. The town was awesome. Everybody just loved us.
And then, on October 25th, 2014, after just 7 weeks as a major league pitcher, Brandon Finnegan made history.
Look at that stat. First player in baseball history to play in the College World Series and the MLB World Series in the same year. 17th overall selection in June by the Royals, Brandon Finnegan.
TCU pitching coach Kirk Sarlos, who pitched in the big leagues from 2002 to 2008, couldn't believe what he was seeing when Finnegan took the mound in the 2014 Fall Classic.
It's kind of a surreal experience. I know it was for him, it was for me. You know, just a couple months prior, he was in our dugout. Now watching him on TV against the best in the world. And I think I was more proud of that day than I was my big league debut.
For his part, Finnegan is humble and a little sheepish about his accomplishment.
And it still hasn't hit me yet, thank God, because I think if it did, I don't know what it would do to my head. So, I mean, I ended up having a really good 2014 year. And they took my hat to the Baseball Hall of Fame, so that's pretty cool.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Steven Steigman at KCUR, the NCAA Radio Network, and Major League Baseball Productions. Our intern is Joe Jacobs, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Terry Pluto, who offers this insight about Cleveland fans.
I have to admit, I did not think at the start of the NBA season that come the finals, there'd be Cleveland fans chanting, "Deli, deli, deli," unless they wanted a sandwich.
Hurry, Cleveland delicatessens, be the first to offer sandwiches on your menu in tribute to Matthew Dellavedova. I guess they would be something diminutive, yet surprisingly good. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.